From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Dr. Al Mooney is the only member of his family who was always sober. His parents, two brothers, and kid sister were addicted to alcohol or drugs. Now Dr. Mooney runs the rehabilitation center that his parents founded after they sobered up. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Dr. Al Mooney and his mother, Dot Mooney. Also, we talk with stand-up comic and actor Gilbert Gottfried. He's whined on Saturday Night Live and in the movie Beverly Hills Cop 2. You can hear him ranting as the evil parrot in the new animated film Aladdin. And if you're still shopping for gifts, Maureen Corrigan has a couple of books to suggest. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. More than 400 exiled Palestinians are spending the night outdoors on the edge of the area Israel calls its security zone in South Lebanon after a failed attempt to enter the zone. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Israel has deployed three tanks and extra reinforcements to prevent the 415 Palestinians from crossing into the security zone. Earlier today, the Israel-backed South Lebanon Army fired mortars and machine guns when the Palestinians tried to enter the zone. Two Palestinians were reported injured. Israeli officials say they expect similar attempts in the future, but warn Israel will do everything necessary to keep the exiled men in Lebanon. The Israeli Supreme Court today postponed a decision on an appeal by human rights lawyers against the expulsions on the grounds that Israel is responsible for the men until an Arab country agrees to accept them. A decision is expected tomorrow. Meanwhile, a 10-year-old Palestinian boy was killed in a clash with soldiers in the Gaza Strip. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
United Nations officials said today they'll send more guards to northern Iraq to help protect the convoys that carry relief aids to the Kurds. The extra troops are being sent in response to the bombings of several trucks carrying the aid from Turkey. Kurdish officials believe the bombs were planted by Iraqi security men while the drivers were taken away for questioning at Iraqi checkpoints. On Friday, the World Food Program suspended the winter relief program for the Iraqi Kurds because of the bombings. The new guards will be sent to Iraqi checkpoints to keep an eye on the passing trucks. Somalia's two main faction leaders started moving their gunmen out of the capital today. The withdrawal follows a 7-point agreement brokered by the United States. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Mogadishu.
The U.S. had no direct role in the departure of some of the city's armed gunmen, but was given the times and the routes to avoid confrontations. General Mohamed Farah Aidid's forces pulled out of the southern part of the city today. His chief rival, Mohamed Ali Mahdi, is scheduled to move his forces out tomorrow morning. The departure of the gunmen could pave the way towards unifying the north and the south of the city, now divided along factional lines. According to a U.S. military spokesman, the two rival warlords each have about 40 heavily armed trucks known as technicals. The truck-bound bandits, who don't belong to either warlord, will be advised to leave the city and radio newspaper announcements. We are talking about a reduction in threat, said the military spokesman today, not disarmament. In Mogadishu, this is Deborah Amos.
Officials in Portugal now say that at least 54 people were killed in the crash of a Dutch jetliner as it attempted to land today in a storm. Four passengers are still missing. The Portuguese government said that 282 people survived with varying injuries. The Dow Jones Industrials lost about a point today to close at 3,212. This is NPR. International observers have charged that yesterday's presidential elections in Serbia were riddled with irregularities. The early results show incumbent Slobodan Milosevic with a substantial lead over Yugoslav Prime Minister Milan Panic. With about 14% of the vote counted, Milosevic had 56% to 33% for Panic. International monitors said the state-controlled media were unfair to the opposition and that at least 5% of eligible voters were deprived of their rights by registration problems. In a surprise last-minute maneuver today, Brazil's recently impeached president, Fernando Collor, forced the Brazilian Senate to suspend a trial scheduled for tomorrow that was expected to definitively remove Collor from the presidency. NPR's David Wellner reports from Brasilia.
President Collor waited until everything was set for his trial. trial in the Senate to announce that he dismissed his defense attorneys. The Senate cannot try Collor on charges of corruption unless he has lawyers to defend him. The president of Brazil's Supreme Court announced this evening that the Senate will appoint public defenders for Collor and that his trial will be held next Tuesday. In a statement announcing the dismissal of his legal team, Collor claimed he had no guarantees for a fair trial in the Senate. His efforts to delay the trial are seen here as an attempt to win over public opinion, but polls show 9 out of 10 Brazilians want Collor's temporary removal from the presidency made permanent, and his eventual conviction by the Senate is considered inevitable. I'm David Walnut in Brasilia.
The Justice Department said today that it's suing 8 of the biggest U.S. airlines for price fixing. The civil antitrust lawsuit charges that the airlines used a computerized fare information exchange system in a way that unreasonably restrained price competition. The defendants included American Airlines, United, Delta, Northwest, U.S. Air, Continental, TWA, and Alaska. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This may be the ultimate in recovery stories. Dr. John Mooney was a surgeon who was addicted to alcohol and pills. His wife was addicted too. Dr. Mooney kept them supplied with drugs by writing out phony narcotics prescriptions. That landed him in prison, where he sobered up. His wife sobered up too. Soon he turned his practice into counseling alcoholics, and the Mooney's home became a clinic for recovering addicts. The Mooneys had 4 children, 3 of whom were still living at home. You'd think the children would never go near drugs and alcohol after that, but 3 of the 4 became addicts themselves. My guest, Dr. Al Mooney, is the child who stayed straight. I'll call him Dr. Al because that's what people call him in Statesboro, Georgia. Dr. Al is now the medical director of Willing Way Hospital in Statesboro, the rehab hospital his parents started after they outgrew the clinic in their home. Dr. Al's father died a few years ago, but Dr. Al's mother, Dot, co-founder of the hospital, is with us too. All 3 of Dr. Al's siblings are sober now and have worked with the hospital. Dr. Al says that growing up in the Mooney house didn't seem so strange at the time.
It was a normal family as far as I was concerned. It was the only family I had ever been a part of, and I really didn't have anything else to compare it to. The first time I really knew that something was wrong and I could identify that was when my dad came back in sober. And all of a sudden, now I do remember confusion before that point. There was like a void in the family, but I didn't identify where it came from. But when I was 11, he was in a lot of trouble from his drugs, went to the Federal Narcotic Hospital in Lexington, Kentucky, and came home sober. And it was like the same body with a different person in it. It was a very strange feeling. And he talked about what had happened. And he was not convinced he was an alcoholic or he was a drug addict, or at least I don't remember that. But one thing that he was convinced of, that there was something outside of us and the family that was responsible for a lot of this, and that he had been told there were some answers to it. Now, that was a relief to me because, in some funny way, as the oldest child in the family, my dad was a doctor, my mom was a nurse, you know, very prominent in the community, and everything was going great. In a crazy kind of way, I had assumed responsibility, at least in my mind somewhere, for what in the family was not happy and fulfilling.
Did your parents try to hide their problem from you? Did they try to pretend like they weren't drunk or they weren't high?
I don't remember there being a lot of alcohol and drugs around. I remember one real bad argument that we had, and it was the strangest argument when I thought about it later on. We were watching TV one night, and I know now they were drunk, but I didn't, you know, the drinks were just around. I didn't recognize that it was alcohol. It was just, there were the drinks there. It was a big part of our life, and it was just normal. But one night there was an argument about whether we should go to bed or watch TV. And about halfway through this tremendous argument, my folks switched sides in the argument. And they switched sides a couple of times. And the strangest thing that night, I remember both of them chasing me and my brothers up the stairs, you know, hurting us to our beds like animals almost. And then I remember them fighting that night. But I do associate the confusion, a little abuse, but not a lot. But the alcohol was just mixed in. I didn't know about the drugs until later.
Your late husband was sent to federal prison in Lexington, Kentucky, for writing prescriptions. What were the charges? Exactly?
Abuse of drugs.
Okay, and those were the drugs. I guess you were both taking.
Right. Right.
So he sobered up in a federal prison.
Yes.
How did that work for him?
I think it was the only time in his addiction that he had been stopped long enough, which I think is real important. He was there 4.5 months, and he was stopped dead. He could not get out. He could not do anything else, and he had to get involved in a program that helped him stay sober. And then when he came home, I went right along trying to help him. I didn't know I had a problem. See, that one of the most baffling things about this addiction is that we can nearly die and never know we've got it, not know what's wrong. I'd been to psychiatrists for years. I had even had electric shock treatments for years for my nervous disorders, you know, from living with the alcoholic, I thought. I still didn't know I was alcoholic, and I never got diagnosed as an alcoholic or an addict. But you can't when you don't tell the doctors that you drink or take drugs. I'd tell them how much he took, but I didn't ever tell them how much I didn't really know.
So when your husband came back from prison and he had sobered up, you stopped drinking and taking drugs too?
I didn't stop my drugs at that time, but I knew I didn't want him to drink. I was doing it for him. And I stopped drinking. I took my last drink before he came home. But the drugs, I didn't know there was anything wrong with that, and I thought I needed them. I did need them. That is my addiction, the need for them. But I continued that, and I went along with him, with the group we were in, and listened to the people, and I identified with those people, not only other groups, but I identified with the alcoholics and the addicts. And I diagnosed myself. And I haven't had a drink or mood-changing drugs since. And that was straight from the psychiatrist and the electric shock treatments and everything. And there weren't any hospitals then. There wasn't any place to go. All the women got put in the insane asylum. That had a lot to do with me staying sober, too.
Do you think the fact that you and your husband were trying to go through this together made it any easier for you both?
Yes, I do, because he had a start on me and had something to offer me, and he did not allow me in any way to interfere with his sobriety and what he was doing and the program he had going to stay sober. And I am grateful for that now, but I did not like it at the time.
How did he function as a doctor and surgeon, too? Was he a surgeon, too?
I thought he was a surgeon.
Yeah, how did he function as a doctor and a surgeon if he was on drugs and alcohol?
Very well, until the very end. We had a lot of people in our hometown that said they'd rather have John Mooney drunk than any other doctor sober. And, you know, that's not good for an alcoholic either.
Right, because it makes you feel like, hey, I can do this.
That kept him going a long time, you know.
But it's not uncommon at all for an alcoholic to excel and work tremendously hard at their profession, because they know that they're having to overcompensate in an area where their lives has fallen apart or fallen apart.
And I was a great enabler.
How so?
I kept him. You know, we nearly loved each other to death, protecting and enabling each other. I would lie for him. I would do anything. I would give him drugs when he needed them, when he'd go into a hospital and they wouldn't keep him comfortable. I would take the medical bag and I would give him something to keep him comfortable, because they didn't keep him comfortable. And then if you stay with them, you need something too. So I would take care of both of our comfort while he was hospitalized.
Dr. L, when your parents started to sober up, what was it like in the house? Was it initially better or was it more tense?
It was really bizarre. It was a new family, a new life, new people that I had never known before. I'd always known them drunk. It was I describe myself like a little duckling that cracks out of its shell when, you know, when it's born. My whole life had been imprinted with that alcoholism, and now it was a very strange change that came over our family. And for the first year, maybe two, it was some of the hardest years I remember. I remember some of the, at home, you know, my mom was going through her drug withdrawal, and a lot of the hostility and a lot of the anxiety, all the emotions that she was going through were taken out on, you know, me and my brothers. The only real physical, we never had experienced a lot of physical violence, but I remember to this day, one morning on the way to school, it was like she exploded, and I curled up in a little ball on the front seat, and her fists were pounding me, and we've talked about all those things since and come and gotten okay with them, but it scared me to death. I did know there was something different, and I knew that there were, you know, I could see something that was different. I didn't understand it. It took a lot of years, and At that time, there were no family programs. There was no understanding of addiction, and my folks were gone off to their meetings and running around the country, beginning to take care of drunks, and it was like, well, first they love their booze, now they love their drunks, and where's the family come in?
So it took a while before sobriety seemed like a good thing to you.
Right. You know, I had kind of a love-hate relationship with it at first. But finally, I guess they got sober enough to understand what the family needed, and we began to do things together. Because there wasn't money to have the material gifts that we used to have, we finally got realistic, and my dad paid off the $600 milk bill that he had, and we did without ponies and toys and some of the material things that had appeased us for a while. But we began to take vacations together. The two things I remember doing was going to conventions of people who were also recovering. And also we went camping. We didn't have a lot of money to spend. So we would go up into the mountains and spend the weekends or weeks at a time camping together as a family. And some of those times I'll treasure forever.
Dot, how did you and your husband start doing recovery work and start bringing people into your home, turning your home into a recovery clinic?
Well, you know, one of the things that's best for alcoholism and in the early stage of trying to stay sober, and I think it's important right on, is to help other people who are suffering. That's where I got some help from. And we just began to go places and meet people, and they would end up in our home because he was known as the drunk doctor, you know. Even after he got sober, they called him the drunk doctor because we were a small town, and if they wanted to talk to find him, all they had to do was call the telephone company and ask for the drunk doctor, and they'd always give him the call. They knew who it was, and people started coming in, and there was no place to put them. So we just took them in at home, and it was good therapy for me.
Why?
As well as for them, because we would shell peas and butter beans and cry and, you know, just do all that crazy stuff together. At least I wasn't the only one. I had other people that were crying too, shelling peas and butter beans and doing whatever we had to do. And it was kind of nice, and it became normal for us.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Al Mooney, medical director of the Willing Way Hospital in Statesboro, Georgia. It's a recovery center for people who have been alcohol or drug abusers. Also with us is his mother, Dot Mooney, who's the co-founder of the hospital and is in charge of women's extended care there. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Dr. Al Mooney and his mother, Dot Mooney. They run a center for recovering addicts in Georgia. Dr. Mooney is co-author of the recovery book. Now, you have three brothers and sisters, right?
Right, two brothers and a sister.
Now, each of them got involved with drugs and alcohol.
Right.
Were you shocked, were you surprised at all when your siblings started using?
I don't know that I've ever thought about that. That's a good question. And I think early on, I thought maybe they would just kind of play in the role. You know, our family now has an identity that's switched from alcohol to recovery. And I said, well, maybe that's just the way they think they can get their attention. And their love in the family was by confessing they've got an alcoholic, and then the family would give them their, you know, the love that they deserve like all these patients. And Over a period of time, I began to, because when I went to college, we separated from my brothers and sister, and we were not very close at that time. I didn't have very much of a relationship with them. We had been pushed apart by the alcoholism. In the last 15 years, we've gotten extremely close, and we've gone back and talked about those days and become supportive of each other. And I'm amazed at what did happen. They saw all this. They heard all this. And yet the facts in their life involved with alcohol and drugs are so clear that they also had the disease of addiction that it's just irrefutable.
Now, how did you decide that you wanted to be a doctor and follow in the footsteps of your father and his father?
It really never was a decision. That's all I had ever intended to do. It was like I came from six generations of I was going to be the sixth generation of physicians. the third generation in our community. I still have a few patients that my granddad delivered. I guess there's probably very few other physicians that have the kind of continuity in medical practice that I have and working with families over generations like this. But it was never a decision. I just knew that was what I was going to do. And I had some stumbling blocks along the way, and some I remember being told a couple of times that, you know, people just didn't think I was going to make it. And I said, well, you know, I've got a contingency plan, and I had it all mapped out. And fortunately, it did work out. I was persistent and moved on through my medical education.
When you were studying medicine, did you plan on running a recovery center? Is that what you had in mind?
No, I initially wanted to be a surgeon, you know, like my dad and granddad. And then some strange things happened. See, every alcoholic I had ever known had gotten sober. I had never seen an alcoholic die that I can remember. I'd heard about it. But anybody who ended up kind of in our system or our network lived happily ever after. And I thought that was what happened to alcoholics and drug addicts. And then when I got into a medical training environment, when I got into real medicine, I remember at Emory when I was a medical student, we had a guy that I know now was in barbiturate withdrawal. He was very anxious and nervous. I didn't know what was going on then, except he had told a medical student partner of mine that he had been taking a lot of these drugs. He was shaking and nervous. I came back to rounds the next morning, and he was gone. I said, where did so-and-so go? And they said, he died last night. And another person who was at Grady Hospital, where I was in medical school, had pancreatitis. Came back the next morning, where's so-and-so? Oh, he died last night. And I began to see alcoholics and drug addicts die, and it was a very strange feeling. I said, wow, this is something I can't believe is happening. These people aren't getting help. And then when I got into my surgery residency, we would do very strange things. I remember a patient who had chronic pancreatitis that every time he would go drink, he would go into tremendous bouts of pain and have to come back to the hospital. It was like he had a built-in reaction to alcohol that should keep him sober, and yet he kept drinking. Obviously, he was a bad alcoholic. But our solution to that problem was to take out his pancreas, give him a 95% pancreatectomy, which left him a permanent and irreversible diabetic and allowed him, I guess, to drink himself to death. I never knew what happened to him. And I began to think about what I was doing and what I had seen in my family and wonder, because there was no specialty of addiction in 1974, I began to wonder if maybe there was some way that my family experiences could ever be helpful in my medical career. And about that time, with what had happened at Willing Way, I was beginning to see that maybe there was a niche for a specialty of addiction, and that led to my decision to go into family medicine and then continue my work in the medical school and do a fellowship and then eventually come back to Willing Way as a medical director.
The whole family is involved, right?
Out of my four children, three of them are alcoholic, and three of them are married to alcoholics, and everybody is sober and happy. And that's most unusual. But I think it's, you know, it's great because we all communicate, we understand each other. And, you know, we were talking a little bit ago about what did we do for people. Mm-hmm. I feel that loneliness is one of the biggest things with alcoholics, and the love that they get in recovery, I think, is very powerful.
That when your children became alcoholics, did you try to do something to intervene? You had already worked with a lot of alcoholics and drug users. Did you try to use your recovery knowledge to help them, or was it different for you with your children than it was with
other
people?
It's different. I've learned that sometimes the families, we can learn what we can do about ourselves, but we can't stop them from drinking or taking drugs. And I knew that. And they, fortunately, the two boys just got help on their own. They admitted it, no confrontation or anything. They just wanted a better way of life, I think. Now, with the daughter, it was a little different. She had many treatments, and a lot of things happened in there, and I had to take a good look at myself because I was into denial about her. I knew it, but I know I didn't want to, and I had some anger about it, and I actually, you know, I was enabling her. We both were, and that's something we knew better than to do, but we had to literally let her go and not even come home, and that's hard with your baby, especially my only daughter. But she says that if I hadn't done that, she doesn't think she would have survived. We were, when we cut her off completely, and that's hard. And I feel like I'm glad I was emotionally ready to do it when the time came, because I needed a lot of help during that time. It was really hard.
Let me ask you this. Now that recovery is so such an almost like popular subject for talk shows and books and so on, do you ever worry that, on the one hand, it's really increased awareness and it makes it possible for people to talk about what they've been through without being condemned for it? On the other hand, I know I sometimes feel like we've killed the language, you know, that we've made everything into such a cliche that it's hard to talk about this kind of thing,
right,
and still sound, still have the words carry the full impact of the emotion and the pain and so on.
Right. We've dressed it up so until it doesn't sound so bad. And that's why I still call myself, and people laugh at me about this, I call myself a dope fiend, because that's what it was 31 years ago when I came in, and I didn't like that. That was a bad, bad, bad word. And codependency, you know, that's a word that's become real popular. And, some places you don't seem to be in unless you've been in treatment for codependency. Well, I call it sick dependent. You know, being dependent on a member of the family is fine. But that sick dependency, I had gotten so sick with my alcoholism and addiction and was so insecure and so fearful of losing my husband that I wanted to die too. And me with three children, and that's sick, you know. And I still use those words that don't sound too good, because I worked hard to get rid of those, that stigma. And I was the only woman I knew in Statesboro that was alcoholic, except one that I knew that said she was. But, you know, I'd been through all of the route of shock treatments, electric shocks. I know all about living better electrically and learned all that. And that just didn't do it. It was not treatment for my addiction. Nobody knew I had it. But it sure did keep me alive until I found something that I could use for recovery.
I think, in regard to the jargon and the movement of recovery, it's interesting that often when a new intellectual area develops or a new scientific area develops, one of the first things to come along is a new language for it. And often when we know the least about the scientific area, the language and the vocabulary embellishes it maybe an excess. Dermatologists, you know, we don't know where a lot of skin rashes come from. But if you've ever been to a dermatologist, you'll feel really great when you leave the office, because you have all these long words of what the rash was. And basically it all means the same thing. You know, they don't really know, but they describe the rash as it looks. And I think a lot of what we've heard in the recovery movement is just that. There's a lack of familiarity with this new emotional understanding, and people try to put it into traditional intellectual slots. And that creates a difficulty that comes out in fancy language and fancy words. And what I believe, and the longer I've worked in this field, the less necessary it is to use a lot of those fancy words. I can talk about love and hate and hunger and being drunk and high, and you don't have to use a lot of the fancy words that you hear.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you. It's really great to be here.
Great to share anything we can about this.
Happy holidays.
Thank you. Same to you.
Thank you.
Dr. Al Mooney and Dot Mooney run the Willing Way Hospital in Statesboro, Georgia. Dr. Mooney is co-author of the recovery book published by Workman Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Yeah.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the cranky man behind the cranky parrot. We talk with stand-up comic Gilbert Gottfried, who does the voice of the wicked parrot in the new film Aladdin. And if you're being steered toward the toy store this holiday season, critic Maureen Carrigan suggests a detour. She recommends a new book you can give a youngster and one for yourself as well. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Little Rock, President-elect Bill Clinton has named former South Carolina Governor Richard Riley as Education Secretary and utility official Hazel O'Leary as Secretary of Energy. O'Leary held energy jobs in both the Ford and Carter administrations and is the second woman and third African American named to a cabinet job in the Clinton administration. At an afternoon news conference, Clinton spoke of complaints from various women's groups and said that bean counters are playing quota and math games, and that his nominations of women to head the Environmental Protection Agency and his Council of Economic Advisers are being ignored. The UN is now taking steps to improve security along roads used by aid workers in northern Iraq. This move follows a series of bombings of trucks carrying relief supplies throughout the region. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
UN officials say they will assign extra guards to ride with relief workers and will set up inspection points along the borders of the Kurdish areas. Officials say that since November 29th, small explosive devices have gone off in 16 trucks as they pass through Iraqi-controlled territory. Unexploded bombs have also been found in 12 other vehicles. No one was hurt in the incidents. The trucks were heading toward the Kurdish-controlled regions of northern Iraq, where the UN runs a large relief operation. UN officials say they have no evidence about who planted the bombs, but in the past they have accused the Iraqi government of repeatedly harassing aid workers. U.S. officials have also been quoted lately as saying that Iraqi troops were massing along the borders of the Kurdish regions and may be planning a new offensive against them. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
A Dutch chartered airliner with more than 300 people on board crashed in southern Portugal this morning. At least 50 people were killed. Peter Miles of the BBC reports.
As night began to fall, rescuers and investigators continued searching the wreck of the Dutch DC-10 airliner for bodies and clues for the cause of the accident. Most of the passengers who were killed were seated in the rear part of the chartered plane, which broke into two parts as it hit the runway. The Portuguese Interior Ministry says it is still not known what exactly caused the crash, but the flight recorder has been found and the pilot is among the survivors. Other survivors said they noticed nothing unusual as they came in to land, except for bad weather and heavy clouds. The ministry said the plane aborted a first attempt to land in the torrential rain and strong winds ravaging Portugal's southern coast. As it touched down on its second try, the plane tipped over onto one wing, scraping the ground as it skidded on. It then caught fire, exploded, and broke into two.
Peter Miles in Lisbon. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down less than 1 point to close at 3,312.46 on volume of some 225 million shares. This is NPR News. In Somalia, various factional leaders have begun moving heavy weapons out of the capital to nearby warehouses. U.S. officials say these weapons will be kept in an assigned area while peace talks continue. There have been questions what effect this will have unless U.S.-led military forces move to disarm gunmen in Somalia. Some aid workers have indicated their concern that the military force is not solving the problem of heavy weapons, but only moving it elsewhere. Military leaders say that it would take a massive effort to capture hundreds of thousands of firearms. In Germany, judges in Berlin have refused to release former East German leader Erich Honecker from prison, despite medical reports indicating a life-threatening liver tumor. Deidre Berger reports.
In a medical report ordered by the court, doctors predict Eric Honecker only has 3 to 6 months left to live. Court sessions are currently restricted to 3 hours due to Honecker's health. Doctors say he will only be capable of sitting through an hour session by early next year. But the presiding judge at Honecker's trial said the medical results are inconclusive, ruling that Honecker is still fit to stand trial. He said the manslaughter charges on which he is being tried are too serious to permit the release of the 80-year-old from prison. Honecker's lawyers termed the ruling inhuman and called on the judges to reconsider the medical evidence. Trial proceedings will resume early next year. For National Public Radio, this is Dieter Berger in Frankfurt.
In London, Britain's highest court has ruled that a British government plan to shut down a number of coal mines is not legal. The British government announced in October that it would close 31 of the nation's 50 state-owned coal pits, but then, in the face of a lot of public dismay, announced that only 10 pits would be closed. The High Court has ruled even to close 10 coal pits is not legal. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Two stand-up comics stretch out in the animated film Aladdin. Robin Williams is the voice of the genie. You know enough about him. My guest is Gilbert Gottfried, the comic who does the voice of the whining, wicked parrot, the pet bird of the evil Jafar.
We gotta keep kissing up to that chump and his chump daughter for the rest of our lives.
No, Iago. Only until she finds a chump husband.
Then she'll have us banished. Or beheaded.
Oh, wait a minute, Jafar. What if you were the chump husband?
What?
Okay, you marry the princess, all right? And you become the sultan.
Marry the shrew.
I become the sultan?
The idea has merit.
Yes, merit, yes! And then we drop Papa-in-law and the little woman off a cliff. Yeah! Curse!
I love the way your foul little mind works.
That manic parrot isn't too far from Gilbert Gottfried's stage persona. He's cranky, loud, and very funny. We invited Gottfried to talk with us on Fresh Air. But when he arrived at NPR's New York Bureau, we discovered he only does interviews in persona. Now, I have sworn off interviewing people in persona. It's too much like talking to a Muppet. I couldn't talk Gottfried into just being himself, so what could I do? I went ahead with the interview. I have no regrets, but that doesn't mean I'm going to change my no-persona policy. Let me give you an idea of how Gilbert Gottfried sounds on stage, sort of like a postmodern Borscht Belt comic. This is the opening of his recent stand-up performance on HBO's One Night Stand.
All right, enough. Enough, stop it. Enough. It's enough, stop. Stop. Stop it, stop it. All right, that's it. That's it. You're only wasting your own time. I don't care, I can wait. You're wasting your own time. Go ahead, I don't care. Go ahead, yeah. Doesn't bother me. It's not bothering me. Not by, you wanna come here? Good. That's the way you're, good. That's the way you're gonna behave, good.
Who were the comics that you heard growing up?
Let's see, all of them. I liked Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy because I loved a ventriloquist who could get away with being on the radio. I thought he had the biggest scam in show business. I always admired him for that. Like, he was a ventriloquist on the radio. It's like being a magician on the radio.
Did you hear Jackie Mason when you were growing up?
Yes. You know, a person like you, this is nothing against you personally. I think you're terrific. You know what I mean?
That's perfect. That's really you would have had me fooled. What did you think of him?
I always liked Jackie Mason. But what he thinks of me personally, this I can't tell you.
You do a really funny impression of two other comics, of David Brenner and Jerry Seinfeld in Deep Conversation.
Yes.
Can you do that?
Well, David Brenner, to me, was always something weird. Something really wild. This wild. You ever wash your hands? Everybody washing their hands, right? You ever comb your hair? You ever...
And then I always thought David Brenner in a conversation with Jerry Seinfeld would be,
Hey, Jerry, you ever eat pizza? You ever eat pizza? Why do people eat pizza? Hey, Jerry, you ever drink a cup of coffee? Everybody likes coffee, huh? Why do people drink coffee? Who are these people?
Do you think that Brenner and Seinfeld have heard this?
Yes, they both heard it. And in fact, a few times, Jerry Seinfeld has said to people,
I don't think that sounds anything like me. Where does she get the idea that I talk like that? I don't have a funny way of speaking.
How did you start doing other comics?
Just basically to annoy people. Like, I started out annoying people, and I want to take it to the nth degree.
Probably your comics, other comics are your closest friends, so I'm sure this is also a technique for ensuring you have no friends left.
Yes.
Is it effective?
Yes.
My guest is comic Gilbert Gottfried, the voice of the parrot in Aladdin. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Comic Gilbert Gottfried is my guest. I was listening to Howard Stern a couple of weeks ago and got the impression you were in the hospital for a while.
Yes, I had a burst appendix. It was a burst appendix. I was actually rushed into the operating room. I was about an hour away. They said I had about an hour to go before I would just be out of it altogether, before I made most of America happy. And if I was any sicker, I would have been on the cover of People magazine's Gottfried's Courageous Fight.
What were your symptoms? Did you call an ambulance or something?
Yeah, I went into the hospital. They didn't even know what was wrong. I was there for about 3 days. And I could have actually died, actually, on the operating. They were amazed I made it. And if I died, then I would have been on Entertainment Tonight, and Entertainment Tonight would be playing their Maudlin theme music. That's when all of a sudden they say, so-and-so died today. Da-da-da-da-da-da. And they drag it out.
The world of comedy mourns one of its own tonight.
Yes. Da-da-da-da. It's like they play their regular theme music, but on a slow speed.
Have you been on E.T. yet?
Yes. And I never actually speak to the people who are the hosts. It's when they do that show, they send out, like, just any flunky they can get to interview you, and then they splice it together to make it look like you're talking to Mary Hart.
So
they usually give you the wrong question, and you totally make a fool out of yourself on that show.
So I guess being in the hospital didn't make you change your mind about staying in persona all the time.
No. I'm staying this way. In fact, when I was in the hospital, I thought, maybe I'll be more obnoxious. So I tried being Buddy Hackett for a while, but it just didn't work.
No, I know I am not able to get Gilbert Gottfried out of persona, but what about the surgeons? I bet you didn't talk to them this way.
No, they knocked me out during surgery, so they wouldn't have to listen to me.
Yeah, but when the anesthesiologists were coming, you know how the anesthesiologists interview you beforehand?
Yes.
They do.
As a matter of fact, the anesthesiologist interviewed me and also showed a clip from some shows that I've been on. It was a very professional hospital. The anesthesiologist sat in the chair. I lied on the couch. And she said, here's a very funny guy, but let's first watch a clip from his latest special. And then she even took a break for commercials.
did she know who you were?
Yes. And then after they wheeled me out, they brought on Charo.
So for me to find out what Gilbert Gottfried is really like when he's not in persona, I have to call your anesthesiologist.
Yes.
And what would she tell me, do you think?
She'd say he drools a lot and he's incoherent.
And when you came out of the anesthesia?
Yes.
You probably spoke like yourself, right?
Yes. No, actually, I spoke like George Papard. Because a few people said, doesn't he sound like the guy from the A-Team?
What was George Papard in before the A-Team? I'd watched the A-Team, and I think, I know I should know this guy, but what else did he do?
I know he was in a lot of those Harold Robbins-type movies.
What are your favorite movies?
Let's see. Aladdin. Beverly Hills Cop 2.
Shameless plugs. Come
yes. on. And in fact, I want all black people to stay home from school and from work to see Aladdin. Because I think it's an important statement. And I only want black reporters to interview me. Plus, I'm going to have, like, hats made up with a little P for parrot.
I think you can consolidate a whole movement.
Yes.
Around this.
There was a pregnant pause, and then...
I'm looking at my notes as if they're going to help me here. Did you ever go to the Catskills and hear any of the Borscht Belt comics there?
Yeah, let's see. I've seen some. I always liked Borscht Belt.
Did you ever vacation in the Catskills?
No. Never vacationed in the Borscht Belt, but would listen to them, and there would always be the comic going, and the Jews and the Italians and my kids in their room, and the Jews who talk to the Italians and the Irish, and the Jews and the kids.
That's it.
Yes.
Yeah, I think they're still doing it. Did you see Catskills on Broadway?
That, I think, would be a bit much for me.
They didn't have Persona comics in those days, did they? You think like, Jackie Mason or Myron Cohen were in Persona? Would you call it that?
It's hard to tell what Myron Cohen was. Myron Cohen was, like, a Jew trying to sound like he's British. It's like, when Myron Cohen would talk, it was always like, an adorable old Jewish woman is walking along the boardwalk. When all of a sudden an elderly man comes along, it was like British Yiddish.
That's true, isn't it? That's true.
He was always trying desperately to sound like he's actually a refined Englishman.
Except the punchline would always be in Yiddish.
Yes, it would be, an adorable old Jewish woman is walking along the boardwalk when an elderly Jewish man approaches her. He says to her, can I take you out on a date? The Jewish woman says, well, I'm busy Thursday, to which the Jewish man replies, a yichen ma seiden, a zuch nadai.
Would you get the joke? When?
Yes. Well, yeah, I just could laugh along with everyone else and go, ha, 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 yeah, a yichen a zay. Yeah, that was, oh, I could see that coming from a mile away.
What's the first thing you ever said in front of a microphone?
I don't remember. That's a good question, though.
You don't remember your first time out?
I do, but I vaguely.
Tell me what you remember about it.
I was about 16 years old, and it was like open mic night in Greenwich Village. Like, not even open, they didn't even call it open mic. This was before the comedy boom. So it was like called Hootenanny Night. So you had about 150 people who was, like, doing folk songs. Like 2,000 people sounding like Bob Dylan. Even the waiters sound like Bob Dylan. Everyone sounded. It was like the waiters would come over. Can I take your order, sir? Can I bring some more bread to your table?
So everybody was doing folk stuff and you were doing comedy?
Yes. And so it was unusual. Then the comedy boom came later on. Now it's like, every single cable station and network station has a comedy show 24 hours a day, practically, where there's a comic standing in front of a brick wall going, hey, you ever notice these late-night TV commercials and you watch it late at night and then you clap your hands together and they got the lady with the clapper, hey, I've fallen and I can't get up. And you know when you get on a plane, they give you those little bags of peanuts and then you get in one of these cabs. Hey, what kind of language are they speaking? Do they speak the same language as the people in the 7-Eleven? What is that?
Why is so much comedy so trivial now?
It gets worse by the second. There's more comedians and less comedy than ever before.
It's so true. Is that frustrating for you?
It's annoying. I like I'm practically like Elvis in front of the TV set. I feel like sitting there with a gun and shooting each comic that comes on.
So Gilbert, listen, the holidays are coming up. Is this a depressing time for you or a good time for you?
Oh, I just adore the holidays because now it means I can watch the Family Ties Christmas show and the Facts of Life Christmas show. They all have an hour-long Christmas show.
Do you usually work around the holidays? Is that a time when everybody else is taking off? Is that the time that you go to work?
Sometimes. I usually like working on New Year's because then it's like I can laugh that I'm getting money on New Year's when these poor suckers are spending their money.
And I guess you don't have to worry about getting a date if you're working.
Yes, exactly. See, then I have an excuse. And then when it's not that, I love the sexually transmitted disease excuse. I go like, oh, before this, I used to be getting women all the time, but now you got to be more careful. Oh, sure. Before this, I had a different woman every hour. But now, well, you can't be too careful out there. That's like everybody who can't get a woman now uses that excuse. Well, sure, until this came along. Boy, oh boy.
Can we make a deal?
Sure.
When you decide to come out of persona and start doing interviews out of persona, are you going to give me a call?
Okay.
All right.
But first I'll do Barbara Walters.
Oh, sure. That's what they all do. You're going to cry?
Yeah.
You're going to talk about how you were abused and that's why you're in persona because the world was too insensitive to you.
All of my relatives were alcoholics and they all beat me, Barbara.
And so after you tell her all of that, then you're going to come on and talk
with
me. Well, thanks. Thanks a lot. I'll remember you too. Happy holidays.
Thank you.
Gilbert Gottfried is the voice of the parrot in Aladdin. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what do you have on the Serbian election?
Hi, Terry. Slobodan Milosevic has a lead in the election there. He would be reelected as Serbia's president if the vote total holds up. But there are lots of accusations against his party for manipulating the voting and the returns. We'll talk with Sylvia Pajoli from Belgrade about what happens next. Lorna Jordan reports from Cincinnati. A cross has been erected in that city by the Ku Klux Klan. Michael Goldfarb reports from London on the passing of actress and drama teacher Stella Adler at age 91.
Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. If you're still shopping for gifts, critic Maureen Carrigan has two books to recommend. The first is a children's book, Emily, that introduces young readers to the mysteries of nature and friendship and poetry. The second is a new paperback collection entitled The Open Door that features 29 famous writers, from Benjamin Franklin's to Stephen King, all remembering how they first fell in love with reading.
Here's what the little kids I know have told me they want for Christmas. One of those handheld video games, a doll called the Magic Potty Baby, something known as the Super Soaker 100, which I think is one of those nasty giant water pistols, and anything, absolutely anything, that's made in the shape of Barney the Dinosaur. Now, I like toys a lot, but all of these kids live in houses that look like the stockroom at FAO Schwartz. So here are the presents I've bought for them so far. A copy of E.B. White's classic Charlotte's Web, and a beautifully illustrated new children's book entitled Emily. It's about a little girl growing up in Amherst, Massachusetts in the 19th century. One winter's day, she's invited into the yellow house across the road, and there she meets the reclusive genius, Emily Dickinson, who gives her a poem. I've reread this book about 6 times since buying it last week. The fantasy of entering into Dickinson's private world on a quiet, snowy day is too magical for me to give up. Besides, I know that when I finally do make myself give Emily to one of the children on my list, the scene that'll follow will look like that old Saturday Night Live skit starring Hanukkah Harry. Remember him? He was the guy a frazzled Santa Claus hired one year when he needed extra delivery help. Hanukkah Harry broke the hearts of all the children on his route by bringing them discount socks. This holiday season, instead of yelling, "Socks, socks," like Hanukkah Harry, I'll be crying, "Books, books," but the kids I know won't hear much of a difference. I don't know what turns kids on to reading, but for many of the writers whose reading memories are collected in the book The Open Door, the key was that one special story. For H.L. Mencken, it was a novella called The Moose Hunters, printed in a pulp magazine. For philosopher Will Durant, Dickens did the trick. Durant recalls being 12 years old and broke and desperately wanting to buy a used copy of David Copperfield. The neighborhood butcher came to the rescue by giving him the 11 cents he needed to meet David and Peggotty and Micawber for the first time. Eudora Welty devoured serious fiction, books like The Five Little Peppers and The Campfire Girls. And the ever-wonderful M.F.K. Fisher, who died this year, describes her awakening into a lifetime passion for reading this way. "Slowly my eyes rowed across the lines of print, and the new world smiled." The book the five-year-old Fisher remembers opening was The Wizard of Oz. So I'll risk being known as a drippy present giver, because maybe some of the children I give books to will discover that they can't put them down. And maybe someday they'll even sound a little like Upton Sinclair. When he was an old man recalling his childhood, Sinclair said this about the books his aunts and uncles gave him every Christmas. 3/4 of a century later, traces of their gifts are still in my head.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. The books you recommended are Emily and The Open Door. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the war in the former Yugoslavia and the history that led up to it. We talk with BBC correspondent Misha Glenny, who has just returned to London from covering the war. He's also the author of the book, The Fall of Yugoslavia. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.